Thank you, everybody. Welcome to our panel on EU copyright articles, what it means in the USA. Talking about the articles 13, 15, 17, they got renumbered a little bit. I'm going to start actually with introducing myself. I'm your moderator. My name is Kurt Omsall. I'm with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending your rights online, as we care a lot about. Good innovation policy through making wise intellectual property choices. The article 13, 15, 17 choices that the EU has made were not wise choices. But we can get into that a little bit more, but I will let my colleagues here introduce themselves. James.
So I'm Jim Nettles. I'm a business and technology consultant. I deal with everything. I do a lot of startup work, small companies, a lot of tech industry, IP, these sorts of things. Also an author. I write fiction, nonfiction, science fiction, fantasy, as well as a lot of work in the future space, business space. I cover a lot of different areas. I came out of media as well. I've worked in and out of Europe and the EU. I still have clients that are there. So I deal with this in a number of different ways, and I feel sure we'll hit some of those.
I'm Courtney Lytle. I'm a local attorney here. I work mainly in intellectual property law, and I represent startups. I've got my own consulting company now. I used to do the big firm thing. I got better. And so I'm working with smaller clients now, artists and startups as a general rule. I also teach at Emory Law School in intellectual property and negotiations and courses along those lines. I have a textbook, but I'm not going to pump that to have y'all read it because it's a textbook.
All right. You want to go over what these articles are about, or what the European filter will be?
So, to kind of boil them down and not dive into the minutia of them, it really kind of is a follow-on to what we see coming out of GDRP and the changes that came last year in a lot of ways. And so, to kind of boil it down, what it really was is the EU is coming in wanting to do things that will provide additional copyrights specifically around digital media. And that's where a lot of this focus is. So it's looking to come and make sure that basically those people who own IP are going to be compensated for that IP in some way, shape, or form. And there's been a lot of supporters on both sides of it. And being the fact that I am both and do a lot of work as a privacy advocate and whatnot, and I'm also a content creator, you know, I actually see and deal with both sides of it. But really kind of what it boils down to is looking at how the IP can be secured, making sure that people are being compensated for IP. If we see things like the meme, you know, the meme ban, the questions along those lines, I feel sure we'll dive into it. But at a really very high level, it's all about making sure that content owners and content providers, and holding those people that are the platforms, the YouTubes, the Facebooks, the major content providers are now going to be held somewhat liable for the content.
How does the filtering part work?
So the filtering part, I think, is going to be kind of a cluster.
That's the main point of the topic here. And I think a lot of people are concerned that having a rule which requires no copyright infringement on the platforms can only be accomplished through filtering. And filtering is not going to be a very efficient system.
Well, filtering is not going to work at all. By the way, sorry I'm late. Hyatt on the elevator system. It took me 45 minutes to get down from the 7th floor. We were on ice. So, yeah. Sorry, my name's Tetch. No, actually, I'm Courtney Lytle. And, I'm the researcher and manager for torrentfree.com, where we cover a lot of peer-to-peer file sharing and copyright infringement cases. And my specialty is actually the kind of filtering systems themselves and their activities and how they work and how they don't work, usually. Sorry about that.
One thing that I think is interesting on that issue is that the statute, such as it is, the directive, which sounds so ominous, they have directives, but their directive doesn't actually technically require filters. And there's a whole lot of yakety-yakky coming from people saying, oh, no, it's not filters. It's not requiring filters. Really, really, it doesn't. But the language in there is one that I never let my clients agree to best efforts. I mean, European law is a little different, but in the U.S., if any time you agree to use your best efforts, what you are actually agreeing to is to do anything that is even remotely possible, not reasonable, but possible, even to the extent that it would bankrupt your company to do it, you are required by that contract to take those efforts, even if it's completely not feasible and completely unreasonable. You have to do everything you can, and there is no way to use that kind of really scary legal language. It seems like innocuous little words. Oh yeah, I'll do my best. Any Cub Scouts out there, you, oh, I'll do my best, that's great. That's not how lawyers see those words. And so they look innocuous, and there's a lot of people trying to talk down the whole impact of the filters, but with that language in there, filters are the only thing that would come close to satisfying that. And so the people, I mean, I'm usually the aggravator on this panel because most of my clients are rights holders, but I think this crap is awful too. And the people who are trying to argue, oh, it's not filters, it is. There's no way that that squishy language that they're using can, in the end, mean anything except filters.
Because, I mean, you could use a genie in a lamp, or a genie in a lamp and say, well, that's about
if
the only other way.
If I had a genie in a lamp, I would no longer be worried about an internet site.
But that's not an alternative to filters.
But correct me if I'm wrong here, that squishy language was the compromise coming out of the EU, because YouTube, Facebook, a couple of them came and said, this is way too restrictive. It gives us no wiggle room. So I agree it's even worse language.
Yeah. In theory, it's supposed to be better, but shy of mandating filters in that exact word, that still does that. And I think that's why most, you know, YouTube and Wikimedia and all of them are still saying, okay, that's not as horrible as it actually is, but we still can't support it. It's actually worse, I think.
I think actually, YouTube already has a filter system.
Oh,
yes. Look how well that's working.
Yeah. Well, I had an article in Ars Technica about 10 days ago. If you're here, you're obviously not at RoboBottles over in the Hyatt, but they had roughly 400 videos taken down off YouTube just 2 weeks ago. Claiming some of RoboBattles and from other events all around the country, just random ones, some unlabeled, just the file name untagged, because it was claimed that they were animal fighting videos. Some people had 120 videos taken down, and some of them got strikes applied to them, some of them didn't get strikes applied to them. There was no other thing except that all of a sudden these videos were taken down for animal fighting.
Well,
when I sent a nice little hey, why are you doing this? What's, you know,
show me the animal.
Yeah, show me the animal, and
it's the hamster running inside the bot.
Before I did all of this kind of stuff, I used to work for BattleBots and do those as my day job, and actually, it was me fighting the robots. But,
were you inside the little box?
Honestly, I was the guy, when they went out of control, I was the one they sent in to kill them. So,
watch out for the swirling saw blade.
I've been literally an inch away from them when they've been doing it at full speed, like 30,000 RPM.
I think you needed a better job.
I enjoyed it. Right until I almost got my face ripped off. But they said, oh wait, sorry, that was wrong, and then they put most of them back up.
But not all of them yet,
and didn't say anything.
We have this, so why, we have these filtering things going on, and there's a long history of filters not doing a very good job. So where do we go from here? So, I mean, first of all, where does the directive go from here?
And I'm going to throw this out there as a hypothetical, because this is a conversation I have with a client that's trying to figure out how to deal with this in the EU. Is I think that hypothetically part of what we're looking at here is two things. Number one is this is majorly going to impact your largest companies, the YouTubes, whatnot.
Will they have the resources to be able to deal with it better than small people?
Yes.
Only the big companies.
It's a differentiator.
So but, maybe it'll help entrench them into power?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It'll silence all the smaller voices because they can't comply with the statute. There are a few little carve-outs that they've added in and say, look, they were reasonable. but one of them says you can't have been in operation for more than
three years.
So, you know, you can have a little startup, but then you have to have another one. You can't actually gain any credibility or market share because if you've been around for more than 3 years, suddenly you have to be able to be YouTube and buy their level of equipment, or not equipment, but the filtering programs, which are not feasible for a small company.
Maybe require human review.
Well, I think we're looking at human review, and I think we'll see some companies come in that will specialize this in this and basically have to be the bot and be that service for these companies. But even that is a contract basis.
Technically, that does not scale.
Yeah, the manpower to be required isn't feasible.
Right. I mean,
even if you outsource it from somewhere where you pay people 25 cents an hour, you still can't do that.
300 hours of video from there uploaded every second or per minute. One of the two.
So, as a practical matter, the next step is that it's going to go to the various countries to implement the directive. So, just a brief overview of the EU system is that the EU in Brussels, the European Parliament, comes together and puts out a directive, and that is a directive to the countries to enact national laws that follow along with that. And there may be some variation in how it is implemented from on a country-by-country basis. And there's also a possibility that some countries may push back against, even though it has passed as a directive. One country, Poland, has gone to the European Court of Justice to say that this this rule, the filtering aspects of it, is unconstitutional under the European treaties. And so that will also have to wind its way through the court. So we're not quite done seeing how this will be implemented, but at least the directive is saying implement this in a particular way.
I think it might be helpful if we take a little bit of a step back and kind of describe what copyright law did before this. We generally, and this is a current issue in America too for a different reason, we've had what's called the mere conduit exemption. Basically, if you are YouTube, if you are, it was first brought up, which is called bulletin boards, where we weren't putting up videos, just lots of comments. If I'm just putting up everything you people post, and I'm not editing it, and I'm not choosing what goes up, I'm not liable for what you post. I'm just a conduit. All this crap is going up. I'm like the phone company, which really was the analogy used at the time, because that was about as high-tech as there was at the time. You know, Bell or AT&T are not liable if someone plans a murder on their phone. And it's the same kind of thing. They're not controlling the conversation, and so the conduits on the internet weren't controlling the conversation either. They were just throwing everything up there. So they were exempted from liability for it, and that kind of made sense, and that also made possible so much of what we take for granted. And that's been the general consensus. Now, what this is doing is saying, oh, well, actually, no, now we're making you liable for it, and you have to control it. And not only is that placing an undue burden on smaller companies that can't afford the big filtering, it's going to just shut them down. And so you're narrowing the stream of information substantially, which is what most people, and like I said, I'm usually the one on the other side saying, oh, it's not that bad, quit your bitching, but I think this is not a great idea. When I'm on the side of everybody else, we know it's going too far. The other issue with the filtering, when you, not only can it not tell robots from dogs, but with copyright law, you have some exceptions. Yes, I can't copy someone else's work, except I'm allowed to use snippets of someone's work for critique and review. I'm allowed to use parts of things for parody. And they're fair use, which is overused in a lot of ways, but the basics are fundamental and important. And this takes that away because there is no way that the bot can make any analysis on, is this a fair use? They're able to pull down a lot of actually infringing work, but they can't say, oh, well, it was a teeny snippet used in a review, this is fine. I mean, it can't tell dogs from robots. You know it can't make a fair use analysis. So what this act is doing, in addition to shutting out tons of small companies compared with before when there was no requirement that they do this, it's also taking away fair use from any of the people who are posting stuff, because the bots that are going to be required will not be able to analyze it, so everything's coming down.
Yeah, and I mean, as both as a content creator and somebody that represents content creators and those platforms, looking at what's happening and what's coming, I think is if you look at who's supporting it, it is the major producers, it's the major film producers, the major music producers, the big five publishers. The small and medium size, I mean, if you look, Neil Gaiman is very much against this. Stephen Fry is very much against this. Many of the folks I know in the tech community, I mean, what this potentially does to gaming, because gaming, the question when you get into the copyrights about gaming and all the different things that come into play, there's a ton of gamers that all came out and said, you just shut me down. Because while the gaming industry sort of allows that to be a little fluid, that you can stream that on Twitch or just Discord or whatever else, that becomes really squishy about, is that original content? Are you being licensed and allowed to play the game and then stream it and create new content because of the experience? I know there's been a huge, it's been a huge debate.
And so here in the U.S., we've had a system that came around in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Which strikes a bit of a contrast from the filtering. So under the DMCA, there is a safe harbor until you're provided with notice. That's something that's up online if you're a service provider. And then there's a procedure by which you can provide that. You have to make the content owner provide the notice. It gets taken down. The person who posted it can say, no, this is a fair use. They can do a counter notice. Whatever reasons why it's not infringing, and it goes through a process at the end of which it either goes back up or stays down. And this system, I actually think, has been misused in a number of ways, but it is at least a system in which there's not filtering. Like,
yeah.
Things go up and then they are discovered to be a problem, and then. Go down. Some other countries, actually, Chile, have it where you have to have a court order to take something down, so that's like turning up the notch a little bit. In the European thing, they're actually trying to sort of undo that process so that it doesn't go up in the first place. And this creates a number. So one of the issues with the DMCA that we have seen is that sometimes people will put out a DMC notice to take something down even though they don't have the rights to do so. And you could have something taken down for 10 to 14 days or so, even if you had like no good claim. And sometimes, this has been takedowns of political messages, like during the campaign season, where having your message be gone for just a week or two is still a problem. And a concern that has been raised, I don't get people's thoughts on this, but a concern is the possibility under the EU system where people will submit things into the copyright system for the filtering, for the taking down, that maybe they don't actually have the rights to, or they are being aggressive about whether or not they have the rights to be charitable about it, and thus causing things that will come down.
Well, it's actually worse that you say that the taking down thing, that kind of stuff doesn't already happen. There's actually been a case recently where somebody used the YouTube system to file false complaints that somebody would have to file a counter notice so they could get their address and use that to then swap them. So that was the thing that was put in to sort of give accountability, and that the publisher, once they could file a lawsuit back, is now being used as a literal means to attack people or threaten their livelihoods.
Any system can be abused, and it's almost ironic in a kind of sick way. That there have been plenty of criticisms of the DMCA, and because nothing's perfect. And I think we're getting to the point where we're going to end up saying, well, yeah, democracy is the worst possible option except for all of the others. And I think we're going to look at the DMCA and say, well, it never worked quite the way we wanted to. And when they started ratcheting things up, it started getting worse. But if you're looking at what's about to be the European system, the DMCA is going to be the good old days. And it's like, gosh, I wish we could be back into that system, because parts of it sucked, but it was so much better than this. And I think that's where we're going with it.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've had to deal with for clients, it's not happened to me, but is weaponizing, a lot of things along these lines, where sometimes it is groups that don't like a particular type of author, a particular type of content. I have a friend who's a romance writer, that part of what she does is male-male paranormal romance, has been very much targeted and using tools like offensive content and copyright notices and all sorts of things on the various platforms, has been used to knock her content down repeatedly. This just becomes another weapon to be able to do those sorts of things and harass people.
All right, we have a question in the audience.
was just... So I guess the problem right now is the consequences are all on one side. So if you file a bad claim, there's no consequence for that, or it doesn't seem like there is, especially with YouTube. You get a copyright strike against your channel, and then the person that issued that not legit claim just gets away with it. No consequence.
They don't get a strike for issuing a false claim.
Right.
Yeah, and it's right before for it to be submitted. The YouTube Content ID system is actually not implementing the DMCA percent, like not following those procedures, but it is doing some filtering beforehand and putting at strikes. And I think you can appeal and get the strike against your account removed, but I don't think there's serious consequences for the reporter.
I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know.
Do you think that would help?
Oh yeah, but some kind of consequences.
It would make people think twice before.
Think twice before they issue.
Especially big companies just claim it all and if we lose,
so what?
Yeah.
If we win, we win, and if we lose, we'll try again.
The Viacom case where they would against YouTube, where they claimed like hundreds and hundreds of videos that their own team had put up of The Daily Show and The Colbert Report as part of it, because they just didn't care. They said, well, there was no penalties for hundreds and hundreds of false claims. But sure, they hadn't actually done their due diligence on all of the work that they were claiming, which brings us to question all the rest of their claims.
Yeah. Now, I was going to say, a little bit like we talked about the other night on the Tumblr panel, when you're dealing with a corporate entity, they're going to also go to the lowest common denominator for minimizing their risk. Mm-hmm. For when they get take down notices, it's easier to say, okay,
yeah,
it's up to the person who's got to appeal and try to get it back up.
I mean, I think on those lines, one way to think about it is if your company like a YouTube, the amount of additional revenue that YouTube gets for any particular video is like trivial to their overall bottom line. And it is a cost to try and figure out what the right answer is. So if they're facing potential liability for a video, keeping it up is not a good economic, compared to the cost of figuring it out and the cost of potentially being liable is down. So there's a relatively strong incentive to take it down. Now there's some pushback on that. Sometimes if you take things down, people make a thing out of it, and I think that is a good thing to complain about it. But it makes it a very tough situation if you want to have as much expression as possible online and not have things being taken down illegitimately, when the economic incentives of the platforms are to not deal with that.
Yeah, the rational behavior for YouTube is to just take it down and then let you guys fight it out and not care if they take down too much, because that's way safer. And you can't expect them to take risks when it's not their economic interest. It's a company, that's what they do. And if your system is set up, yeah, and now Europe's making it even more so. Europe's not only making it, taking where we are, which is it's more risky to leave something up than to take it down, they're banning it, in effect, doing everything you can to take stuff down.
Do we have another question?
We do, right over here.
Hello?
Yep.
So I want to hear your thoughts on the use of this copyright system, because I don't think, well, you already have like this big apparatus that they're putting in place, and that will already knock out a lot of political speech. But I'm just wondering, how much can it be weaponized? How much can it be used to just crush down on really anything that doesn't fit the happy image that these companies and places trying to want to portray?
I'll start with one example. In the earlier days of internet copyrights, a lot of the cases came from when religious texts were being placed online, in particular Scientology. So Scientology's Religious Technology Center, or RTC, was the holding for their intellectual property, and they used IP to do as much as possible to remove criticism and commentary about their religious texts.
And their religious texts.
Yeah.
The secret texts were being posted, and they were doing all they could to take those down.
In many cases, it has been used for that kind of censorious purposes, starting in the early days.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, I would tell you from a commercial standpoint, there's a lot of ways to weaponize it and use it in terms of both political strategy as well as if you are, you know, insert group A here, I'm not going to pick on anybody in particular, but let's say you have a particular religious group that has hold certain beliefs. If they don't like content that someone else is producing, actively today there is harassment of artists and creators every day using the legal tools, even though they're unfounded claims.
And as I said just before, there's been a case where somebody's used it just to try and get them so they can swat them, you know, send armed police agents to raid the house and offend on a false call with the possibility of having the people killed.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things that's not always appreciated is that there have been a lot of complaints from the more right-wing politicians and viewpoint folks, and we're not talking actual white supremacists, we're talking folks who said, hey, I like Trump. And it's become, I mean, even things have been weaponized to that point. Whether you think that, you know, Trump is good or not, anyone should be able to recognize that if voicing approval of a political candidate becomes hate speech, we're going down a bad path. You don't have to approve of it, but you can't shut down an entire political opinion or an expression of, you know, saying, I think the president's great, and people who are saying things like that are getting shut down for hate speech. And when you have that kind of political activity going on, weaponizing it, it doesn't always have to be against someone you don't like. That weapon is then available for use against everything.
So, you talked about how small companies were going to be much more severely impacted by YouTube, but Google has European offices, and a lot of small companies don't. I was wondering how they were going to be able to project the power to enforce these EU copyright laws outside of companies based there.
Yeah, so that is a good question. If it gets implemented in all the member states, what are they going to do about it if somebody is a small provider in the U.S.? Some thoughts on this?
Go ahead. No, go ahead. I'll use a specific client who owns a software company that does mailing lists, mailing services, contact generation for sales services. He is a British citizen living in the United States, and he has about 15% of his client base is in the EU. Sitting and having a conversation the other night, the discussion was, the GDRP, when it came through, he started limiting which countries of the EU he'd work with, and we were having a conversation the other night, and now he's literally looking at saying, I will no longer do business with EU countries. The only clients he's going to keep in are going to be the UK citizens post-Brexit.
If it goes ahead.
Yeah. So I think a challenge, of course, with any national law is whether you can sort of enforce it outside the boundaries. And as you pointed out, the large service providers are most definitely in Europe, and there's not a big question of whether they have to comply, at least for their European properties. And sometimes this has come up where, you know, the .fr or, you know, .d and such will have a different set of things available than in the United States in the .com, though this has also annoyed the Europeans, because they're like, well, everybody goes to the .com, so we want you to have the entire world comply with our European standards. And the companies will probably be able to handle it, and if you are a small US-only based company, and you hopefully don't get to either the attention of the EU or don't go to Europe very often, then, you know, maybe you can get around from complying with their law. They may not sort of care enough to go after every small provider. But this also has an interesting side effect, which is it entrenches the currently popular international one, so that you can be a small company and get out of this and stay out of it by continuing to be small.
You can't grow.
But you can't. Yeah, you can't grow. You can't become a competitor to the existing platforms.
It's a lovely way to maintain a monopoly. There's another little twist to it that has a domestic correlation here. California often drives the automotive standards, because the Detroit or whoever else is going to say, well, we can't make different cars for California and for everyone else, but California is such a big market, we can't just not sell our cars there. So whatever fuel standards and environmental standards California implements, in effect become national standards. And to an extent, you could look at Google and places like that, perhaps saying, well, we have to do all this stuff in Europe. It doesn't make any sense to do it only in Europe and try to bifurcate where we're filtering, where we're not. So the restrictive rules that are about to be implemented there are very likely to then become the rules that the large corporations are using here, too.
And at the same time, how many of you seen websites nowadays that ask you, we're going to put cookies in your thing, do you agree with the terms for us to put cookies on your website? Everybody seen that?
Yeah.
On websites
yeah.
now?
Yeah.
That's basically from yeah, the GDPR. That's an EU regulation. Everybody's basically accommodating it worldwide.
Because it's easier to do it
globally
across the board than to try to target where it is and where it isn't.
Especially
so
if you miss out the wrong one, you know, you can get in trouble. So you've got to overdo it to make sure you don't let things slip.
It's better to impose the bad rules on everyone than to miss a person and get in trouble. So we're going to end up being impacted by the most restrictive stuff that they're doing because the larger corporations are going to just do it everywhere.
And I think there's one other thing that is the penalty. So, I mean, for GDRP, the worst penalty you've got is they can take a percentage of your revenues out of the UK if you're not in the EU.
They access worldwide revenue, 4%
yeah.
worldwide, or 20 million euros.
Right, up to, yeah. But they still have to be able to get to that if you're not in the EU, which has been the question.
Right.
With this, it's a much more direct penalty. If you're using these platforms to market, to advertise, to build your branding as a small company, it's a much easier weapon here that can actually much more greatly impact you than the potential financial penalty of if you screw up on the GDRP for your web mailing list.
Question on the front?
Yes, hey. You basically just answered the question I was about to ask, which was, as a North American YouTube content creator, would I be impacted by those European rules? And you just basically said yes, because they'll be implemented worldwide. No, doesn't that mean that you enlist private companies to police free speech by filtering content?
Yes.
And it affects these, okay,
that's why we think that's pretty awful.
Doesn't that directly clash with existing laws that protect free speech?
One of the important thing to realize is that U.S. standards for freedom of expression under the First Amendment are very different from the European standards.
Very
so they do have a notion of freedom of expression, of course, in Europe, but it is not nearly as strong as what we have in the United States. And so the European regulations have some language in them about caring about freedom of expression, but not it's not going to meet what we consider to be the U.S. standards. But the U.S. law is protecting you against the government censoring your speech, and so if companies are doing this sort of voluntarily because they think it's easier to have one system worldwide, then you don't have a good First Amendment claim against
it. Yeah, your First Amendment claim would be if the government kept you from saying it, but you know, Google won't let you post, you know, YouTube won't let you post. Well, okay, so go stand on the street corner and talk. The First Amendment is still satisfied because the government has not stopped you.
Where the First Amendment could help you is if a European court said that you are liable for putting something that would be protected by the First Amendment and tried to enforce that judgment here, and then a U.S. court would say, well, that's nice, but that we can't enforce any judgments that go against the First Amendment here. So
except that if you're deemed to have been present in the foreign country, the First Amendment does not travel with you. You're subject to the... If you're in Germany, you didn't bring your constitutional rights with you. You're subject to German laws. And this is one of those interesting only to lawyers questions about jurisdiction. If your web, you know, if your web presence is present in Germany, you know, the Germans say, well, we can regulate it because it's here. But could they actually enforce it in Germany? You couldn't enforce it here, most likely.
If your assets were in the United States and they wouldn't. Anyway, jurisdiction
but the
would be a fascinating topic, but
not
I think,
what we need to get into.
Go.
But that's kind of where that was leading. So how much they could impact against you that way. But
and where your servers are and where you're hosting.
And that's where it gets interesting only to lawyers.
Yeah.
It's funny that you bring up Germany. I'm a dual citizen.
Oh, well, then you can't get away with skipping the German laws when you're here.
All right, a few more questions, yeah.
Okay, mine actually is kind of falling into that jurisdictional. I am a Canadian who streams on Twitch, an American company, at a time frame in which my viewers are all European. Am I now going to have to change my time frame because I can't stream for Europe because of their rules? And how is that going to mess up with the fact that I'm Canadian? We don't have the same First Amendment rules, and I don't even know what we're doing with the whole new rules in Europe at all, because I'm following Twitch's rules, not Canadian law rules.
Well, that's the thing. You're going to, it'll depend on what Twitch decides to do and what's going to be, they're going to put into their contract and their user agreements that you agree to.
Yeah.
So read real carefully the user agreement when you sign up, when they update them, because
they're, what we're anticipating is that Twitch and all the others will change their rules to comply with Europe, and that's when you're going to start having problems with things that would be perfectly legal here or in Canada will suddenly not be allowed in Europe, and so the most restrictive rule is going to apply to everyone.
So I have to follow Twitch rules,
well,
even if
you don't even have to get to the international law issue. Twitch is going to enforce their rules.
Yeah, and I think though one I guess piece of medium news is that in that they haven't yet implemented these directives in Europe. Exactly how they are going to play out still is a bit in flux. And so the companies are probably trying to devise some systems to prepare for that, but have not yet gone there, so it'll take a little while before the effect will be realized, and probably at that point there will be a little bit more clarity at least as to what the company's attempts to obey this rule, what their filtering will be. I'm very concerned that this is going to be overly restrictive, and I can certainly imagine that in at least parts of what people are going to be streaming on a Twitch service will involve something that might have a copyright, such as a video game that you're playing or a board game that you're playing, and whether or not those content creators, many of them think it's great to have their stuff being streamed on Twitch, and hopefully that would mean that they won't go through this system to try to stop it, but we'll see if it overfilters.
You mentioned before that you didn't think that there would be transnational bifurcation, but doesn't that already exist in China? Doesn't Google have a different service in China? Microsoft have a different site in China? Why wouldn't that trend be the one that continues?
China is a huge market, and their government imposes it. If you want to have any presence in China, you have to do exactly what the government tells you. And China's huge, so it's worth Google's time to do that. It's with Google's looking at the difference between making it a little more restrictive or whatever is here in this country. It'll be the same thing for the whole free world, if you will. I mean, yeah, China's different. It's behind a big old wall.
But you see my point, right? Yeah, the European market is huge. Why not do something specific for them?
Well, and they did. They have done some, I guess, more than bifurcation, like multifurcation.
Yeah.
Where,
right,
I mean, so, I mean, moving aside from copyright areas, there, some of the European countries have rules against the sale of Nazi paraphernalia.
Yeah, I was thinking of that, exactly. You can't even advertise anything close to that on any German website.
And so if you go to, .de, ebay.de, or eb.fr, you won't find anything for sale there. And then the question has been whether that's good enough to basically just use the country code domain and apply the rules there, or whether it pulls one. And this creates a very important global point that if you do have to apply this on all of your services instead of having it be country by country, then we go to the lowest common denominator, right? The most restrictive is the only one that's acceptable in all of the countries. And if you really don't want to have an internet in which every most restrictive country's regime is being applied simultaneously.
And the other thing is, China, all the internet connections are registered with the government, so there's they know that this connection is China because this connection is registered as Chinese with China. So, it's not like there's going to be like a random ISP address like here. So,
There's no making a mistake about that.
We know this is a Chinese IP because it's registered with the government of China. This is a Chinese IP source. So, we know the Chinese content rules apply to this one. There's no mistake that it might not. It might,
We don't.
Is it going to be a German? Is it going to be German one? Is it because you know Diggy or it slipped through that and the ones out there?
And just one thought about the eBay rules about they'll filter out the Nazi paraphernalia from the European countries that don't allow it to be sold. I question whether that, and they do it usually by the country code, I question whether that would count as best efforts under the new directive. Because, I mean, best efforts is a seriously scary legal term. And I don't know if that's best efforts. That's a nice try, but sometimes stuff filters through, so maybe you have to ban the sales everywhere. That might be your best effort, and the court could very easily find that.
And the only other thing I was going to add is one of the things that we see that's happening is, much like California drives the, you know, like you were talking about the CAFE standards and all for automotive, is if you are in a particular country that has, whatever that view is, if we're going to see these large platforms continue to conform down to the lowest common denominator, then all that does is continue to shut down communication, freedom, and everything else worldwide.
And at the same time, of course, we're shutting out the smaller voices. Mm-hmm. So the large voices are being much more restrictive about what they will allow to be posted because they have to, and the small voices are being silenced completely. This is not a good thing.
And actually, going back to weaponization, this is one of those things where, let's say you've got a small or medium platform that is ramping up, that is getting a following, this becomes a weaponization system where you use bots, you use people to target that platform to just overwhelm it.
Great question.
My question actually has to do with websites like Tumblr. So Tumblr obviously does have original content. It has, you know, advice and things that people write and, you know, go get them slogans. But a lot of it is, it's a site that's founded based on fan art, fan works, fan appreciation. Do you foresee a website like that surviving if these kinds of rules go forward?
Yeah,
good question.
I mean, Tumblr is an interesting example because it barely is surviving, even right. It was bought for peanuts by the people who wrote you WordPress.
Automatic.
I think that is a very challenging thing where you have sites, and I think that there's a couple of sites sort of in the category of where you're putting up your own content that may be a fair use, but it'd be hard for a filter. Like if you're doing fan art, hard for a filter to make a determination about whether that is a fair use of the underlying work.
And even with, if you're doing pictures of, something that Disney owns, which I think is everything now, even Disney lets you do fan art to an extent. They won't enforce against you, but if it's a bot doing the enforcing, you can't expect Disney to not file their important IP with these filters, because that would mean any use is okay, and they're not going to go that far. Normally they'll say, yeah, okay, keep going, we don't mind. They're smart enough finally to know that it's actually good for them to allow fan art and such. But the bot doesn't know the difference, so there'll be no judgment. Even, you'll look back to the good old days when the evil mouse got to make the decisions,
And it comes down to the end of the question, how do you define originality? What is original? Where is the point where that's derivative, that's original? Where do you put that line?
People disagree, bots will never know the difference.
I think it goes back to fair use. It's just, it becomes almost invalid in terms of
fair use is being written out completely. Yeah. Where the line is in fair use is always squishy and is something that lawyers love arguing about, but this is writing it out completely.
Courtney, you talked about the fact that if they get banned from Twitter, they still are not banned from free speech. They can go elsewhere and talk. Mm-hmm. Well, there's now an argument being made that Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, places like that, constitute the public square. Even the president posts there. So the argument's being made that banning them or eliminating them from the effective digital public square is a suppression of free speech.
That's
the argument's being made.
I think that's a great argument, because that really is how speech is done today. If you're getting to the constitutional issue, though, the requirement still remains that it be a government action to silence it. You don't have any censorship rights against the EFF panel. You don't have any censorship rights against your employer. You have censorship rights against the government. That's the only place the Constitution applies, is against government action. So if Twitter silences you, the government... Now, if the U.S. passed a law that required Twitter to censor public opinion or censor political speech, that law would be unconstitutional. But Twitter's action to comply with a European law can't be unconstitutional, because Twitter's acting on its own, and it's acting in a way that our government can't act, and it's acting in a way that our laws can't require. But it's someone else's law, and Twitter's just complying with it. That's not a violation of our constitutional rights.
So now we have a corporation is the de facto government.
That's one of the big problems with this right here, is that we are in effect allowing Europe to limit our freedom of speech. And I mean, I get annoyed when I see Twitter and all of those doing what they're doing already with political bias, because it's the offensive minority views that have to be protected for freedom of speech to mean anything. And when Twitter and the, in effect, public marketplaces start censoring according to their own political views, you're killing freedom of speech. It's not speech you agree with that needs protection. It's speech that offends you that needs protection. I get hot about this one, but what we're seeing now is Europe limiting our freedom of speech.
And, go ahead.
But there's no constitutional remedy there at all.
I mean, I think there's like an interesting question of whether the Constitution would prevent Europe from enforcing the law on the U.S. companies. And I think, you know, this came up a number of years ago where a French organization went after Yahoo for activities that Yahoo was doing in the United States, and ultimately they were unable to enforce the French law against Yahoo. However, if the companies voluntarily do it worldwide just because it's like easier...
It's in their economic interest to do it.
That's a different story.
I think that the French court couldn't impose, or any of the UP or any of the EU countries, or the EU counselor, whoever's coming after us next, can't enforce their judgment in a U.S. court, because then you have government action enforcing that unconstitutional action. But if you're in Europe, they can get you there. They couldn't enforce your assets here, but the companies themselves aren't going to be in trouble for voluntarily taking action to cover their butts against the European Act.
And the only other thing I'd add to that is, go back and look at who is backing this for the EU. Look at the companies and the corporations that are ones that are funding and driving the effort to get the EU to pass this.
It's the big established monopolies that want to remain big established monopolies.
And shut down everything else.
Because once you're a monopoly, you don't want competition, because, you know, it competes.
Another question?
So, isn't this basically just destroying country sovereignty? I mean,
yes.
You already have six companies that control 95% of the media. You have just a couple tech monopolies that control everything. I mean, we're basically already in a de facto one world state. It's just we haven't really gotten rid of the borders part yet. So I just wonder what your thoughts on that. And also, do you think blockchain technology could do anything with that?
No. Do you think blockchain technology? No.
We're having sort of billions of people like are on Facebook. I think they are getting close to 3 billion these days, and I think we maybe have 6 billion in the world total. Their biggest impediment to growth is getting more people on the internet. they have a big program to try and bring the internet to places so they can continue to grow.
Get them hooked on Facebook.
I don't want a system in which we replace things like the Bill of Rights. We replace some of these core fundamental values with codes of conduct.
Especially codes of conduct written in Belgium. I mean, their laws are not as
Strasbourg.
Are not as respective of individual rights as ours. I mean, that's one of the pieces of our history that matters. That's how our country was founded, on being obnoxious and loud. And they don't share that heritage, and their laws are we don't quite get that. Because you go to Europe, it looks like here, but quainter.
Gee, thanks.
We travel.
Gee, thank you.
She forgets I'm British sometimes.
But it's lovely and comfortable there. We, as Americans, don't always appreciate that what we understand is who we are. We take it with us. We assume that's why they all hate us. We are ugly Americans when we travel. But it doesn't seem horribly foreign and horribly awful. But the laws are different, and the assumptions are different, and the cultures are different. And where you want to live, that's lovely, but it's not a great idea to allow the most restrictive country in Europe to set our laws. They don't start from the same assumptions we do.
And the only thing that does still give some degree of balance against this is the fact that we as the U.S. have a lot of the technology and technological innovation, and we still have the heavy economic power. As the economic power slides, then our leverage in the world is going to continue to slide as well.
Yeah. What's the timeline for the implementation of these systems?
2 years, and we're down to about a year and a half.
Yeah, once they passed it through the EU Parliament, each individual country has 2 years to implement the laws in their own sections. They've not yet gotten to the point where there's only one set of laws, but they all have to comply. That's kind of how our treaties work. When we signed on to the Berne Convention, the International Copyright Convention, we had to change our laws to comply with the restrictions of the Berne Convention. We had the Berne Implementation Act ages ago, much behind the rest of the country, like in 89 or so. We had to change certain things. That's when we did away with some of the formalities in copyright registration, things like that, because we had to comply with this, with the treaty by virtue of becoming a signatory to it. Europe just works that way all the time. Once the directive is passed, then all of the countries have a certain amount of time to make their national laws comply with the directive. It was 2 years from when it passed, which was...
February?
I thought it was a while ago, so a year and a half-ish.
But then again, there's no penalties for not making that timeline. There are some countries that
are objecting to it, and they'll drag their feet.
And 4 or 5 years possibly for some Poland, Sweden.
There's at least one challenge to it in the European court system by Poland, so that might also slow down the process.
Yeah.
And we can also, in this 2 years, if it is possible to turn this around. I think it's a hard thing to do, because a lot of the countries that will need to implement it were in favor, but not every country, and there might be some changes.
A lot of the countries, if you look at the votes, it's actually interesting, because the most, among the top like 5 votes for it included England and Germany, who also cast the most votes against, one of the top 5 votes against it. So even some of the countries that cast enough votes that it passed, because the individual members vote. And so sometimes if you have a lot of members, they disagree. And so some of the countries were split, which gives you the idea that their nation is split and their individual legislators will be somewhat split. So even with the mandate that they pass it, tell Congress to do something quickly. Good luck with that. That we do share with the world. And you'll one day have to explain to me the British rules, because I've studied them and I still don't understand when they have to vote and when they don't. So a lot of countries can drag their feet if a chunk of the legislators are against it.
So is YouTube gonna probably implement it within the next 2 years, or they're just gonna wait and see what happens?
It depends what they decide makes sense and what their council tells them is the safest route.
I think what YouTube is gonna try to do is have the national laws say that content ID is best efforts, good enough, and they don't have to do anything. That's their ideal state, right? Is that their system that already exists becomes the standard that everyone else has to build and implement, and they get to just have what they've already had. Other companies may, of course, also try to say what they are currently doing is the right thing, but from YouTube's point of view, content ID, wouldn't that be great if that was the standard? And
got it and everybody else has to get it.
And so if there was that digital authenticator that says this is the copyright under it, there was a full tag that goes all the way through, and any content would have to be tagged. Again, that's a suppression.
Yeah, you're suppressing smaller voices.
That leads to my question, which is about indemnification. Isn't the entire purpose of a company to indemnify you as an individual from a certain set of consequences? And so couldn't you simply have a series of tiny companies that indemnifies the bigger companies from the costs of this? Every time you make a part of a movie, you have a separate company that is responsible for that, so that they're all judgment-proof if you sue them.
Well, so I'm pretty sure, I haven't given much thought to this one. I would have to say that attempts to, of course, hack the law have generally not worked out. I've seen very few of these kinds of, what if we use this aspect of law, and strung it all together to defeat this system, where that has successfully gone on. And keeping in mind, to the extent that you did, then the same forces that brought the law in the first place can adjust the law to deal with this thing that they hadn't expected and that created a loophole, or judges can say, well, that doesn't work. So, I mean, I,
Yeah, we call it piercing the corporate veil, and it's the corporations or LLC is still a great structure to, you know, if you're opening your own business, by all means incorporate, protect your personal assets, but there's hoops you have to jump through. And the, but that's against an individual's assets. When you're trying to do a company insulating himself with subsidiaries, it could be done to an extent, but if that became the strategy the companies were using to get around the EU law, it would be real easy just to throw in a, oh, we're piercing all those corporate veils if there's evidence of strategy to avoid this law.
And I wonder, I should probably just add on that. While we talk of things like, you know, YouTube and you know, Google is all part of the Alphabet and so on, all of their European operations are part of a wholly owned subsidiary that is a completely separately created entity, and they probably have, you know, one per country, and many of the large companies will have hundreds, if not thousands, of entities already. So they're like as onto this one as you might as they think they can get away with, but they also are not feeling that because officially, you know, Facebook Ireland is the entity that does all the stuff in Europe, and it's totally separate from Facebook US, that that's going to hold up.
And even if they were, you know, one, if the US version of Facebook is insulated from the Irish one, the parent company is the same and doesn't want any of the subsidiaries to start being shut down because they were not violating, because they were violating the law. So you're not really insulated against being shut down and quiet and fined if just because you have a couple tiers of subsidiaries. It's still money and censorship. That makes sense. It doesn't sound like that.
All right, we got 2 minutes left, so I think we got time for another question.
Oh, yeah. So theoretically, the UK doesn't leave the EU. I think it probably will, but let's just assume it doesn't. Do you think the EU copyright laws could be enforced in Commonwealth countries, or does the UK not really have any?
No, the Commonwealth is a separate. Commonwealth laws are, there's no really such thing as Commonwealth laws. There's, you know, it's, the Commonwealth is extremely difficult to think, but no, European membership is what determines European laws. And the laws, even in the UK, the laws aren't uniform. There's laws for England and Wales. Scotland has a completely different legal system. And then Northern Ireland has another set of laws and regulations. So it's a lot more like, it's basically, the UK is basically three states. Two of which have civil court systems, and the Scottish system is Scottish. So it wouldn't go beyond that even. So I mean, even it's kind of three laws. The, you know, Parliament has sway over the United Kingdom, which is England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, Northern Ireland, but
and the Isle of Man.
Somewhat, yeah, the Crown Penitent territory. Yeah, but
sorry.
And those, but yeah, it doesn't go like, and you know, sometimes Jersey, Guernsey, the Sark, but it wouldn't be elsewhere like Gibraltar, for instance, so much, but, or well, perhaps Gibraltar's the wrong example, being right where it is, but other places, it wouldn't apply so much, so it wouldn't apply at all. So no, the EU thing would work for the EU memberships, which is not the Commonwealth countries; they're not EU members.
But one effect of England exiting the European Union is they would no longer need to comply with a European Union directive. And so they may nevertheless go forward with some sort of similar thing, but it would no longer be required. They may end up with their own direction. Well, that brings us to the end of our time. We ask that each one of you take out your phone, go to the DragonCon app, and please rate this panel.
Rate it highly.
Read it as you see fit. Of course, what a great job.